tonight on Arena. James McBride on the ethnic turf wars of Brooklyn, and we review the second instalment of Dear Ireland at the Abbey Theatre. You can text us on 51551 or tweet at RTE Arena. Filmmaker Christopher Nolan has been making headlines since March. Nolan, the man behind such acclaimed box office conquering hits as Inception, Dunkirk and Dark Knight Trilogy, is refusing to move his latest film, Tenet, to streaming services in the wake of COVID-19. He has made a film for the cinema and now hopes that the crowds will come to see it on its release date, August the 26th. Tenet will be the first Hollywood blockbuster to be launched in this new and unfamiliar theatrical landscape. We thought this would be a good time to look at Nolan's work. Just how did this independent filmmaker with a nose for the quirky go on to become the billion-dollar king of event cinema? I'm joined by Chris Wasser, who's going to tell me exactly why that is. So, Chris, all I have for you is a word, Tenet. That's all I know from the trailer. That's what the trailer says. So is that all we know?
That's all we know. I mean, most people have been talking about this film for the last 6 months, but they've been talking about the fact that Nolan refused at first to push the July 17th release date. Of course, he was kind of, forced into delaying it week after week after week. But now it looks as though we might finally get it. It's due for release in 70 international territories on August 26th, followed by a staggered US release in major cities from September 3rd or 4th. But he has kept this film so much under wraps that it's actually quite extraordinary. All we know is that John David Washington is in it. Well, we know who's in it. Michael Caine, Robert Pattinson, Elizabeth Debicki. It's about a spy played by John David Washington who is going to manipulate time in order to prevent World War III. That is all you get from the trailer. And, you know, that's kind of typical of Nolan in the films. He's always kept things under wraps until the last minute. But with this one, even more so, which has actually, you know, encouraged Nolan fanboys online, of which there are many, to think that perhaps this might actually be a follow-up to Inception. But, you know, we don't know anything just yet. All we know is that Nolan is a staunch supporter of cinema and he was never, ever going to let this one go to streaming
services.
And was
there a fight with the people who wanted to stream it?
Absolutely. Warner Brothers, you know, look, I'm sure the suits at Warner Brothers do not want to lose money on this. This cost $250 million to make. It will need to make at least $600 in order to break even. It's a huge financial risk to put this out in cinemas. And Nolan has come under a lot of criticism due to the fact that he is asking people to come back in the cinemas. And he hasn't really asked us if we're ready or not to come back to cinemas. So everyone involved is taking a risk, but Nolan will not budge. This will eventually make its way onto streaming services, but not before it's in cinemas.
And the cinemas have bought into this.
Cinemas have bought into it, yeah. I mean, this is going to be the first and only Hollywood. This is going to be the first Hollywood blockbuster to open. I mean, everyone from Bond to Marvel to Disney's Mulan, they all got pushed. This is the only Hollywood film. This is the only large-scale event film of the year opening in cinemas. So cinemas will be excited because at the moment we've got, like, you know, low-key Irish films. We've got independent international dramas playing. Cinemas will be excited to have something that they know people will come out for, hopefully.
But a big challenge for them.
To have it safe.
So we're here to talk about where do we begin with Christopher Nolan. He is a student, not a filmmaking.
No. He studied at University College London, but he decided to pick up a degree in English literature because he knew he wanted to be a filmmaker from an early age. But he thought, well, you know, I'd like to keep my options open and also train on the side. You know, there are fabulous filmmaking facilities available at this university. He went on to become president of the Film Society. But he thought, you know, I'll also work on my writing at the same time. It's the usual kind of, you know, young filmmaker story with Chris Nolan. He had his parents' Super 8 camera. He was making films with his toys and cardboard boxes and built little sets at home. The upside was that he actually had an uncle who worked at NASA who was able to supply him with launch footage that he filmed off of a television using his Super 8 and then incorporated it into his own little Star Wars homage when he was a teenager. And I think everyone in his life at that point thought, this kid's going to be a filmmaker. So he went to UCL, and while studying English Lit, he met Emma Thomas, who would go on to be his wife and who would produce all of his films. And she, you know, backed him in so that he could go on and start making shorts that would impress at film festivals. And notably, his first feature made for £6,000 called Following. And it's these early shorts and the likes of Following. I mean, one short in particular, Doodlebug. It's a 3-minute short. It's a little psychological thriller. It's about a man chasing a bug around his apartment only to discover discover that he's actually the bug. And then Following, which follows a man following strangers around London, you know, looking for inspiration for his novel, only to end up in his own story. They're not very well filmed, but there's something about the ideas and the pacing and just the spareness of it that a lot of critics and even major studios thought, this guy's got ideas and we want in.
Now, when it comes to the first set of film you're going to talk about, Memento, his brother is very involved as well.
Yes, Jonathan Nolan, who has been involved in most of Chris Nolan's films, actually. All of his films are family projects that usually start in Nolan's garage. Nolan, who is actually from Westminster, but his dad was English and his mum was American, so he kind of divided his time between London and Chicago. He and his family have always made their stuff at home, and when he married Emma Thomas, it was the same thing. They start work in their garage or at home, and Jonathan had written a short story about a man looking for the murderer. His wife has been murdered, and this guy has driven himself crazy looking for her murderer, but the whole story was told backwards. And Chris Nolan, on the back of earning a lot of money with Following, was all of a sudden approached by Summit Entertainment. They gave him $4 million, which to this day, he says, that's still the biggest leap that was ever, you know, that
and
he's ever taken.
On the back of Doodlebug and Following, the other movies
that's
that he made.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he was
and
able
a good
to,
idea.
And a good idea. He was able to, with Following, he spent $6,000 on it and it made $250,000. So this guy had something. So with Memento, we were seeing, you know, a neo-noir about a man played by Guy Pearce who is trying to figure out who has murdered his wife. The only problem is he has short-term memory loss. And so, and then on top of that, the entire film is told backwards. There are sequences in black and white which kind of move the story along forwards, but most of the action, as it were, is, you know, we start at the very end and we work our way back to the beginning. So
we're all with him trying to find out what happened.
Trying to chase the film as well, yeah.
Lenny is played by Guy Pearce and he's suffering from this form of short-term amnesia. And he meets Natalie, who's played by Carrie Ann Moss, for what he thinks is the first time.
So you have information for me.
Is that what your little note says?
Yeah.
Must be tough living your life according to a couple of scraps of paper. You mix your laundry list with your grocery list and you'll end up eating your underwear for breakfast. I guess that's why you have those freaky tattoos.
Yeah, it's tough. It's almost impossible. Look, I'm sorry I don't remember you. It's nothing personal.
I do have information for you. You gave me a license plate number. Had my friend at DMV trace it. Guess what name came up? John Edward Gammel, John G.
Do you know him?
No. But his face on his driver's license looked really familiar. I think he's been in the bar, maybe. Here's a copy of his license, his registration, photo and all. Are you sure you want this?
Have I told you what this man did?
Yeah.
Well, then you shouldn't have to ask.
But even if you get revenge, you're not gonna remember it. You're not even gonna know that it happened.
My wife deserves vengeance. Doesn't make any difference whether I know about it. Just because there are things I don't remember doesn't make my actions meaningless. The world doesn't just disappear when you close your eyes, does it?
Guy Pearce as Linny and Carrie Ann Moss as Natalie. It has that real noir feeling about that conversation, doesn't it?
Definitely, yeah. And that might be maybe the third or fourth scene in the film, but in terms of the story, it's something like the 16th or 17th scene. It's a fabulous picture and it impressed critics, it impressed audiences. Again, made a fortune, earned it grossed 12 times its budget at the box office, and also earned Chris Nolan his first Oscar nomination for Best Adapted Screenplay.
And how quickly did you go back to see it again to see if you could piece it together?
Oh, within the same week.
I'm ashamed to say, but in the same week,
yeah. There is actually an option. There is a version out there where you can watch the film backwards. Even though it is backwards, you can watch a proper kind of from the first scene to the last. I don't want to do that. That's part of the novelty of the film.
So things got bigger after Memento, didn't it?
First
he did Insomnia with Al Pacino and Robin Williams. And then he convinced Warner Brothers to relaunch the Batman film franchise.
Yeah, so at this stage, Batman was dead in the water. We had Joel Schumacher's Batman Forever, Batman and Robin. Batman was the laughingstock of Hollywood. These films were just
George Clooney's.
The George Clooney and Val Kilmer ones, disastrous, absolute disasters. And Around 2002, Chris Nolan, after having again success with Insomnia, had a 15-minute meeting with Warner where he had this idea to make a grounded, realistic, low-key Batman film, and to do as Richard Donner had done in the 1970s with Superman, to try and convince a gang of A-list actors. It was going to be an ensemble piece: Christian Bale, Michael Caine, Liam Neeson, to star in this superhero film. So it would be sort of, high caliber offering, and let's take Batman away from those disasters in the 90s.
And it was more a gangster set, wasn't it?
Yeah. He basically wanted to make a puzzling crime film that just so happened to feature a man dressed as a bat at a center. And Warner took a chance on this, and I think that's why, we look at the Marvel Cinematic Universe and those 23, 24 films and how they revived the superhero genre. But I think Chris Nolan properly revived it, because the first Batman film that he directed and wrote, Batman Begins, arrived in 2005 at a time when studios would not take risks on superhero films. But this wasn't just another superhero film. This was a Chris Nolan picture, first and foremost. It had everything about those, it had the same themes and ideas that you could see in Memento and Following. There were puzzles involved. Audiences had to chase the story. The protagonist was someone who was kind of, grieving, and his grief and his confusion took him into dark places. And it was a hit. And I think this is the film, when we talk about the revival of the superhero genre, this is what kickstarted it.
And great performances, of course. The Dark Knight is the second in
the Dark Knight is the second installment. Yep.
So in this one, Batman is played by Christian Bale, and he's interrogating the Joker, played by Heath Ledger.
Where are they?
Killing is making a choice.
Where are they?
Choose between one life or the other. Your friend, the district attorney. Or is brushing bright to be. You have nothing to threaten me with. Nothing to do with all your strength.
Don't worry, I'm gonna tell you where they are.
Both of them. And that's the point. You'll have to choose. He's at 252nd Street, and she's on Avenue X. That's Cicero.
Which one you going after?
Rachel.
So that's Christian Bale as Batman and Heath Ledger as the Joker. And I was saying, what's that thumping? And you're saying he's actually thumping.
He's smacking him over the head. Yeah.
All right. Okay. Yeah. was that the beginning of, had Marvel started at that stage, Marvel as we know it now?
The Marvel Cinematic Universe kicked off the same summer as The Dark Knight. So Chris Nolan was already two films into his Dark Knight trilogy when Marvel were just getting started.
So, as you said, Nolan has this knack of incorporating complicated stories and twist ideas into mainstream blockbusters. What are the recurring themes in the films?
Yeah, I mean, he somehow manages to sneak sometimes these art house ideas into these, summer popcorn movies, as it were. With The Prestige, for example, which he made in between Batman Begins and The Dark Knight, employing Christian Bale again, and Hugh Jackman also in one of his great dramatic roles. On the face of it, this looks like, a really kind of slick period thriller about warring magicians. And, there are magicians who fall out over something, that's what it is. But what it's really about is a magician in the 19th century who loses his wife in the most tragic of circumstances and never gets over it. And again, as I said earlier with the Batman character, his grief and his confusion and his frustration, his anger, his jealousy, they take him to some incredibly dark places. And I think that's interesting that, that is a recurring theme in almost every one of his other films.
Yeah, can we talk about Inception, which is another one, is a man played by Leonardo DiCaprio, and he's very much grieving.
Yes.
His wife, played by Marion Cotillard. But then there is this very complicated story about dreams and diving deep into dreams.
I mean, it's weird that Chris Nolan is probably the most bankable director in Hollywood who can convince a studio like Warner Brothers to give him $200 million to make an original story, but not just an original story. I can't even begin to imagine what the pitch for Inception was like. Well, there's four levels, and there's this dream level, and then there's this time that runs in this level, and then there's this limbo. I'd say it was so complicated, but they just gave him the money just to shut him up. But it worked out. So we are getting that familiar story of a man whose wife has been killed. He has actually been charged with her murder, and he's on the run all around the world. But he's also using, he's a spy for a secret organization, and and his skill set is one that sees him go
You're
into the
You're doing fantastic now, Chris. But let me, we'll ask Leonardo DiCaprio, who's playing Dominic Cobb. He's the architect of dreams, and he kind of explains the plot at the beginning of Inception.
So Saito, we can train your subconscious to defend itself from even the most skilled extractor.
How can I do that?
Because I am the most skilled extractor. I know how to search your mind and find your secrets. I know the tricks, and I can teach them to you so that even when you're asleep, your defense is never down. Look, if you want my help, you're gonna have to be completely open with me. I need to know my way around your thoughts better than your wife, better than your therapist, better than anyone. If this is a dream and you have a safe full of secrets, I need to know what's in that safe. In order for this all to work, you need to completely let me in.
Enjoy your evening, gentlemen, as I consider your proposal.
Leonardo DiCaprio there as Dominic Cobb. I know it's a blockbuster Inception, but still, I found the most moving parts of that film was this idea of somebody trying to get back to their wife through their dreams.
Yes, and the idea that he becomes addicted to the technology and uses it every night so that he can dream of his wife and be with his wife, that is incredibly poignant and it is moving. And it's worth remembering that, you know, it's like what I keep saying, he makes these blockbusters with a brain and with a heart.
Do you have to make the big fussy blockbuster around those wonderful ideas?
That is a good point, but he has said from an early age that he was always interested in sort of sophisticated international esoteric filmmaking. You know, one of his favourite filmmakers is Nicholas Roeg. He was always a huge fan of Stanley Kubrick's, but at the same time loved the James Bond films, loved Star Wars, Indiana Jones, and he just thought, wouldn't it be amazing if I could combine the two, if I could entertain people, but if I could also give them something a little bit more substantial than, you know, another Michael Bay, you know, explosive actioner.
And do you think that he is limiting the depth of his talent, his artistic talent, because he's going big, or are you all for the blockbuster, or the, you know, how unique he is in being able to do both?
That's a good question. Yeah, sometimes I do think it might be great to see something a little smaller from him. Sometimes it would be great for him to go back and do something like Memento, like Following. And I was actually intrigued when he went into Dunkirk that he decided not to make a World War II picture, but to focus his attention not just on the evacuation of Dunkirk and World War II, but this one single event. But again, he incorporated big ideas into that. He couldn't, you know, I think Steven Spielberg at one stage gave him advice and said, maybe leave your imagination outside, focus on the authenticity, the history, but he worked in his obsession with the nature of time again, and as a result came out with a unique and fabulously choreographed film.
Yes, you're a great fan of Christopher Nolan's, but particularly of Dunkirk, I think.
Particularly of Dunkirk, I just thought it was just an immersive piece of pure experiential cinema. You know, sometimes I am a huge fan of Nolan's. That doesn't mean I think he's flawless. I think sometimes, you know, I do get a little tired with the fact that all of his protagonists are white males who, you know, are often overcome with grief. I think himself and his brother Jonathan, they need to work harder with their female characters. And I also think sometimes the stories kind of, you know, take priority over the characters themselves. Sometimes, you know, you're missing a bit of personality and they can be a little too earnest. But with Dunkirk was almost a two-finger salute to his critics like myself, who said, you know, there's a bit too much exposition there. You know, you're giving us too much characters. Dunkirk has absolutely no characters whatsoever, but it's pure cinema. It's just about this evacuation, and it takes place on land, sea and air, and land, sea and air over a week, a day and an hour.
Yes,
and he wove
there are
them
different timelines to go with the different stories.
Yes, but he somehow, and different timelines to go with different stories, but he somehow managed to weave them so that they play out in our time, which is just extraordinary.
Yes, let's listen to a clip. We're on the boat with Dr. Dawson, played by Mark Rylance, and he's helping evacuate the people from, or the troops from Dunkirk, and he picks up a soldier who is Cillian Murphy, but then they have a disagreement about the direction they should go in.
There's no hiding from this, son.
What is it you think you can do out there on this thing?
It's not just us. The call went out. We aren't the only ones to answer, you know.
You don't even have guns.
You have a gun?
Yes, of course, a rifle, a 303.
Did it help you against the dive bombers and the U-boats?
You're an old fool. I'm not going back. I'm not going back. Turn it around.
I'm not turning around.
Turn it around! Turn it around!
Calm it down, Meg!
Mark Rylance and Cillian Murphy there in Dunkirk. If you could influence Christopher Nolan about what he'd do next, Chris, what kind of project would you like to see him do?
I think it's easy. I would sit him down and say, make your Howard Hughes biopic. He has wanted to make this for 25 years. I believe that when Scorsese unveiled The Aviator in 2004, he was heartbroken and he just decided to stick his screenplay in a drawer and lock it away.
And probably too early in his career. Well, Scorsese was going together with his own.
Yeah, I mean, at that stage, he just had Memento. So maybe it was a bit too early. But listen, I would say to Christopher Nolan, The Aviator wasn't that great. I didn't think Leonardo DiCaprio was right for that role. Apparently, Nolan's version, and he used the ideas actually in the Batman films to great effect, but Nolan's version, he always had Jim Carrey in mind, and I think Nolan, Jim Carrey, Hans Zimmer, stick Wally Feister in there, his cinematographer, I think that could be sensational.
You think Leonardo DiCaprio was too sane for Howard Hughes?
I think Leo was too young at the time to play Howard Hughes, so maybe he could do it now, but in The Aviator it wasn't right. I would love to see Nolan
tackle this. And it's 2004, so it's a good while ago.
Yeah.
Well, Chris Wasser, thank you so much. Tenet is released in Irish cinemas from Wednesday, August the 23rd, and Inception is re-released in Irish cinemas tomorrow.
Every time I see you, I just don't know what to do. Every time I see you, I just don't know what to do.
And that was David Keenan with his version of the Van Morrison track Slim Slow Slider, which was recorded for the hot press event Rave On Van Morrison, taking place this month to mark Van the Man's 75th birthday on the 31st of August this year. Hot Press has curated 75 musical tributes by 75 artists to mark the significant birthday. And these performances are being released via YouTube across the months of August and September. The artists include Imelda May, David Keenan, as we've just heard, Bob Geldof, Clonard, and President Michael D. Higgins, to name just a few. Hot Press is also releasing a special Van Morrison issue next week. For more information, visit hotpress.com. You're listening to Tuesday Night's Arena. James McBride is an American writer and musician. He is well known for his 1995 memoir, The Color of Water, which has become an American classic. It describes his life growing up in a large, poor African-American family with a Jewish-born mother. His most recent novel is Deacon King Kong, set in a housing project in Brooklyn in 1969. It describes the melting pot of ethnicities living cheek by jowl in the project called The Cause. Sportscoat, an old church deacon mostly dismissed as being a bit of a lush, one day shoots a known drug dealer, and thus he triggers waves of happenings and a turf war in The Cause. James McBride joins me now from New York. James, you're very welcome.
Well, nice to see you. I mean, nice to hear you sound. I love that, the sound of that Irish accent. That just makes us wiggle all over.
As does yours. Deacon King Kong is set in the projects in Brooklyn, New York, called The Cause, as I said. So this shooting of Deems Clements, the local drug lord, has a knock-on effect on the whole community. Can you describe what happens and the effect it has on The Cause?
Well, it's like someone tosses a stone in the pond and the wave pushes out so that the Italian, you know, the local Brooklyn in those days was very mixed. And so within a 10-block radius of the projects, everyone is affected by the shooting, because the drug dealers who are black are pushing into the Italian mob drug dealers, and the church that he's involved with, which is very, you know, very, has profound, is deeply rooted in the community, is trying to survive and to keep its young people from going on drugs. And then you have the cops, who are, many of whom are Irish Americans, one of whom is a major character in the book, and they're dealing with vice and the changing world in which, you know, a neighborhood which they once patrolled, and they lived there and they were friends there, and those who want to stay and those who want to leave. And so the shooting causes the neighborhood to kind of wake up to the changes that are coming. And these are the, and this is the reaction to these people during that period, during 1969, when, you know, it was the 60s and, you know, civil rights and blacks were Negroes and Irish was still getting over the, you know, the not getting over, but, you know, the Irish American community was involved in with the IRA business and all of that. You know, everyone had their little world, and this shooting pushed everyone into a space where they had to deal with one another.
Now, we would love you to read from the book, and there's a lovely description of free cheese that was given to the cause residents by the City Housing Authority. Do you want to set it up for us a little bit first, James, and then read that wonderful passage?
All right. Well, every Saturday morning, every first Saturday of every month, this magnificently good cheese would appear at the projects in a basement boiler room, and everyone from the neighborhood would come around to get the cheese. And so this is my description of the cheese. The cheese was free. It came like clockwork for years, every first Saturday of the month, arriving like magic in the wee hours in Hot Sausage's boiler room in the basement of Building 17. 10 crates of it, freshly chilled in 5-pound hunks. This wasn't plain old housing projects cheese food, nor was it some smelly, curdled, reluctant cheese material snatched from a godforsaken bodega someplace, gathering mold in some dirty display case while mice gnawed at it nightly to be sold to some sucker fresh from Santo Domingo. This was fresh, rich, heavenly, succulent, soft, creamy, kiss my ass, cow's gotta die for this, delightfully salty, moo-ass, good old white folks cheese. Cheese to die for. Cheese to make you happy. Cheese to beat the cheese boss. Cheese for the big cheese. Cheese to end the world. Cheese so good it inspired a line every first Saturday of the month. Mothers, daughters, fathers, grandparents, disabled in wheelchairs, kids, relatives from out of town, white folks from nearby Brooklyn Heights, and even South American workers from the garbage processing plant on Concord Avenue, all patiently standing in line that stretched from the interior of Hot Sausage's boiler room to Building 17 outer doorway, up the ramp to the sidewalk, curling around the side of the building and to the plaza near the flagpole.
That's fantastic. That's James McBride reading from his new book, Deacon King Kong. The book is essentially focused on the character of Deacon King Kong, the name at the front of the book, or Sports Coat, which is another name he has, and his real name, which is Cuffy Lampkin.
Right.
He's also known as a baseball coach and a deacon. So how would you describe him?
Well, I would describe him as like the uncle that we all know who shows up at Christmas and takes out his teeth and puts them on the countertop and says, you know, bring me a straw and a beer. So I've known many sport coat. That was his name. That's what everyone called him. I've known many sport coats in my life. And one of the really fun things about writing these kinds of characters is that the projects where I was born is a world that most people, particularly white Americans, only see from behind the wheel of a tightly locked car. But there's an enormous amount of joy, an enormous amount of patience and intelligence, and there's an enormous amount of dimension and life that takes place that isn't related to drugs or crime or white people or black people. It's just life, and it's people getting along. And so I wanted to show that this is a world that I love a lot. That's a lot of fun, that deals with the issues that most of us have in the ways that most of us normally deal with them.
Yes, because there's a strong central core of Sports Coat and the African American community. But then, as you said, there is the Italians, represented by Thomas Elefante, and then the Irish, represented by a character called the Governor. But then there's the very moral policeman called Potts. What was your experience of the Irish growing up in the projects? Was it the kind of moral Irish policeman, or was it the dodgier governor type?
A little bit of both. I mean, you have to remember, if you grew up in New York when I did, Irish people were everywhere. They were your classmates. They were, you know, look, when the New York Times came to take my picture, they took it at McSorley's, which is the oldest bar in America. And the late Pete Hamill, who just died recently, was a close friend of mine. And I think that the relationship between blacks and Irish Americans when I was a child was not quite as complicated as those as the relationship between the wider white community, in part because there is a streak in the Irish, at least I can only speak for Americans. Now, I can't speak for Irish people who are Irish, but I can speak for Irish Americans. There's a streak of compassion and understanding for people who have less. The Irish people got a little bit of that. I don't know what you say. I mean, I don't want to talk out of turn, but it's sort of they know what it's like to suffer, and they can still crack a good joke and make fun of it and themselves, even though they know at some point the world's going to break your heart. And black people know all about that.
Yes, and I think it's quite nice that Potts, this policeman, is quite romantic.
Oh, he's a delightful character. One of my favorite characters. I used to, well, I, you know, look, if you grow up in New York, you see all kinds of, policemen, and most of them are good. Some of them are horrible. But I used to live on 42nd Street, on 43rd Street. And I used to know an Irish cop who would walk, you know, he didn't walk the beat, but he was an old cat, an old dude, older guy. And he was just delightful. And so when Potts popped up in my mind as a character to create, I kind of aped him after that character. This guy was a former boxer. He didn't arrest you all the time. He was very, very smart. And he was very honest. And, you know, so.
How did the projects or the cause come about? Like, were there other neighborhoods flattened to create them that everybody was living, all the different communities were living so close to each other?
Well, the cause is based on Red Hook, which is where I was born. Red Hook at one time was a shipping community where the quote unquote immigrants, so-called American immigrants, mostly Irish and Italian, worked the docks to pull the cargo off the docks that came into the harbor. That area was raised and a housing project was built, and it was mostly Irish and Italians, and then mostly Italians, and then the blacks and Latino people moved in. And surrounding that area were the Irish and Italians and the Jews, who all had their little enclaves. And so it's based on the real parts of Brooklyn. Now you have to remember that because people live so close together, they had to communicate and they had to work together. This group owned delis, this group ran the bars, and so on and so forth.
And as you've explained, folk get on much better than you would expect. What about America now? I mean, I guess Brooklyn is more gentrified, but other areas with Trump in power and the Black Lives Matter movement coming to the fore. Is it a very difficult, is it, do you think things are simmering, or do you think this is very positive, people working together to change things?
I am very proud of the young people in this country. I never thought I would see the things that I'm seeing. I mean, there's a lot of negativity because we have the guy who's running the country has the brain the size of a full-grown pea. But young people here, of all types and all colors and all of all races and backgrounds, have really come together in a way that I never thought I would see in my life. So I'm enthusiastic about the future. I never thought I would see young people marching, for black folks. I mean, I just never thought I'd see it. I mean, and there's a lot of them, and they're mad, and they have something to be mad about. I think they don't have the same mental baggage that my generation and the generation before me has. So I think that I'm very enthusiastic and very encouraged about what the Black Lives Movement has done. And I think we have the cancer out, now we see it, and we're destroying it. We're pushing it, we're learning how to fight. It's painful, but I'm very proud of what these young people in this country have done, and they're all different colors.
Yeah, I think that this novel reflects that kind of positivity you're talking about, because even though it's about crime, you give every individual has their own strong character and their own crisis in life or wanting, to get on with their lives or have a real life. Even the gangsters, like the young drug dealer, he's a real person, as is the mafia boss, Elefante.
Well, your responsibility as a writer is to create fully dimensional characters. A mafioso will tell you, well, I mean, if I had listened to what society told me what to do, I'd be, you know, I'd be driving a fruit truck or serving, you know, selling fruit down on Carmine Street somewhere. So, you know, your responsibility is to, one, to create fully dimensional characters, but two, and most importantly, show the commonality of the human experience for everyone. And look, the nature of journalism is to find out what's wrong. But my job as a writer is to find out what's right, because there's so much that goes wrong. It's almost a miracle that we can't even get along now, because so many people take so much advantage of our trust and our desire to love each other and to love God and to be good and so forth. So I make sure that all my characters are fully dimensional. I mean, there's an interracial love story in this book, and it's about a white Irish guy who falls in love with a black woman who's in church. I mean, and people say that doesn't really happen, but yes, it does. You know, you are what you believe, and you are the sum of what your life, what you pay attention to in your life. And so I choose to pay attention to the things that work as opposed to the things that don't.
Well, James McBride, it was a delight to talk to you, and thank you so much for reading from this wonderful book called Deacon King Kong, and it's published by Penguin Books. Perhaps some of you will have taken to the highways and byways over the last few weeks and experienced the restorative powers of the beauty of this country has to offer us as we travel around it. Well, one poem that really captures that power is Seamus Heaney's Postscript from his 1996 collection, The Spirit Level. Let's hear it now, read by Ruth Nega.
Postscript. And sometime make the time to drive out west into County Clare, along the flaggy shore in September or October, when the wind and the light are working off each other so that the ocean on one side is wild with foam and glitter, and inland among stones the surface of a slate grey lake is lit by the earth lightning of a flock of swans. Their feathers ruffed and ruffling white on white. Their fully grown headstrong heads tucked or cresting or busy underwater. Useless to think you'll park and capture it more thoroughly. You are neither here nor there, a hurry through which known and strange things pass. As big, soft buffishings come at the car sideways and catch the heart off guard and blow it open.
And that was Ruth Nega reading Postscript from The Spirit Level by Seamus Heaney. That recording was made in conjunction with the Seamus Heaney estate to mark the release of some limited edition letterpressed prints of five of his best loved poems, including Digging, Scaffolding, and as we've been hearing, Postscript. The editions are made in Dublin by Stony Road Press, and for more information, visit stonyroadpress.com. In April of this year, the Abbey Theatre launched the online digital project Dear Ireland, a series of 50 monologues exploring life during the COVID-19 crisis. The monologues were written and delivered by 50 writers and 50 actors and streamed on the Abbey Theatre's YouTube channel. Last night, the Abbey Theatre launched a follow-up to Dear Ireland entitled Dear Ireland Continues. But this time the public were asked to write letters. Dear Ireland, telling our country how they were feeling at this time. In Dear Ireland Continues, the letters are read by actors, commentators and public figures in a two-hour performance from the stage of the Abbey Theatre. Helen Meaney took a look at the entire performance for us, and she's with me now. So Helen, will we go back to the original first, Dear Ireland? What was the offer there?
That was specially commissioned new plays, monologues that were presented online only in April as a very rapid response from playwrights and actors working on these very short monologues, and so they were essentially online dramas, but presented really with on screen only in a sort of quite a limited visual way. So this is entirely different, really, in that it is opened to anyone, to members of the public, to write, and then that was all of those were then, you know, trawled through and selected. So this is the voice. These are the voices of ordinary Irish people or people who have immigrated to Ireland or who are living abroad. So it's saying, like, please give us what's your life like now? What has it been like under COVID? And what do you want to say to Ireland? And I mean, people responded in different ways to what that was.
And it's a more formal presentation in some ways, because most of the other ones, because we were deep in lockdown at the first year Ireland, they were self-taped by the actors involved.
Whereas their beds and, you know, in tiny cupboards and, yeah, really limited physical and visual space. So this is very different in that it's actually in the Abbey Theatre, which, of course, is not open to audiences. So the auditorium was empty, and occasionally the camera would pan over the empty seats and, you know, in a way making a real point of the fact that there is no audience, but we are the audience at home looking it on camera. So it was filmed, and each actor in turn comes onto the Abbey stage and, you know, is lit and very well, and it's actually filmed really well from behind and from different angles. So it's not just... It's to get us away, I think, from just looking at people's faces up close on screen, which, my God, we've been doing since March. So it was a more, there was a staging to it, even though it was very simple.
So let's talk about some of the individual letters and performances. I think you wanted to start with a letter by Alice McLaughlin, read by Ruth McGill.
Yes, I mean, I think the ones I'm picking really are trying to give a sense of the range of experiences. And this is a woman in her mid-30s who loses her job in Dublin because of the pandemic, and finds herself back in her hometown living with her parents in her family home. She's 36 and she's saying, you know, she's unemployed. What am I doing? You know, I'm lost.
Okay, let's just have a little listen to Ruth McGill reading Alice McLaughlin's letter.
The last 3 months have been hard on both of us. But I tried my best. I really tried. It's time to leave Dublin. I don't want to leave, but how can I stay with no job and no chance of one for a long time? I never imagined that I would be back living with my parents at 36. I am trying to keep hopeful. The town is slowly reopening here, so hopefully I'll find a job and an apartment. The only thing is, being back in my small hometown is so hard as a single woman in my late 30s. I dread bumping into girls from school. So many have moved home with their husbands and their kids. I know I'm going to hear the question, "So, what are you doing now?"
Ruth McGill there reading and Alice McLaughlin's letter. It's so true, isn't it? You know, it really encompasses different little dilemmas, little human dilemmas and bigger human dilemmas that people are going through at the moment. But that woman who had made a life's decision to move to the big city, yeah, and suddenly she has to kind of defend herself back home.
I know. I mean, you can just imagine how awful that is. And I think what the letters captured was that everyone's experience of the last few months have been very specific. And because it depends on your work circumstances, your family, and there's a lot of people worried about other members of their family that was coming through the letters, worried a lot about other people. And that was a lovely theme that emerged of a caring, a generosity and empathy, which came through a lot of the letters. People worrying a lot about asylum seekers and immigrants, people in direct provision, you know, homelessness. So that I think what came across was a real sense of social solidarity in Ireland, which was quite touching.
Yes, that sense of caring for people comes across very strongly in when Catherine Walsh reads Bridget Galvin's letter.
A letter from Bridget in Cork. Dear Ireland, as a child in 1970s Cork, the grey hatch in the wall of the Peacock Lane laundry was a source of intrigue. Being above my head height, I was never privy to the faceless voice and disembodied hands that would proffer the brown wrapped parcel, grasping in exchange the large green notes of payment. On the car journey home, I would stroke the smoothness of my parcel companion, tracing the sharpness of its corners and wonder at the perfection of its bow-tied string. I would struggle to make out the small handwritten docket. 8 sheets, 10 pillowcases, 4 bolsters, 2 tablecloths. Ignorant of linen laundered by tears and heartache. Dear Ireland, there are things that we see as a child, things that imprint themselves indelibly on our mind's eye, that sit there, affecting and disturbing, until later on in life when adult sensibilities empowers one to reason and understand. And so it was, with the invite to the Christmas sale of work. I was excited to finally see inside, beyond the world of the grey hatch and brown parcel.
It's a great piece, that's Bridget Galvin's letter read by Catherine Walsh, actress Catherine Walsh. And then, of course, it goes on to compare the Magdalen Laundries to direct provision.
The connection she's making is with the expression in the eyes that she remembered of the women in the laundry and that she's now seeing in a direct provision centre near her, and she's talking about them being sort of hollowed out and shells, and then she makes a very powerful direct address saying, you know, have we learned nothing? Are we just going to repeat this? And it was very powerful because you think, well, who is she addressing there? It's Dear Ireland, but it's really Dear Government, you know. So everyone's version of who Ireland or what Ireland was that they were addressing in the letter was different. But a lot of them were very much about social issues that were political and of social justice.
And we do hear immigrant voices as well.
We do. And there's quite a few. And one is about casual racism on the Lewis. There's another of a young woman who came to Ireland who's born in Russia. And she's talking about her experiences of racism, and then the fact that, you know, her mothers and her extended family are all working as cleaners now, Eastern European women cleaning our hospitals and our nursing homes, and suddenly they've become visible, and that we're all, you know, Irish people in Ireland are grateful that somebody's doing this work that you know, was what they had to do because they couldn't get anything else.
There's another piece now we're going to play a clip from. This is Ren Dennehy's, he's the actor, and he's reading a letter by Sean Denyer.
For our rights were hard won and can be sharp taken away. Don't believe me, Ireland. Look what's happening in Poland, in Hungary, in Russia, in Uganda. When someone needs a scapegoat, throughout history, we are always near the head of the queue. So, dear Ireland, yes, we are grateful. Yes, we are thankful to live somewhere mostly safe, mostly accepting, mostly equal. But we also remember. We remember that our rights were not a present. They were taken by us. We made you give them to us. We literally went door to door, dragging our wonderful allies along with us, and literally begged you to allow us to marry the people we loved. And you said yes. Well, and nor should you ask us to.
That's Ren Dennehy there. He's reading a letter by Sean Denyer. And there, I thought that was great. Our rights were not a present.
We took them. And also a reminder that how recently, you know, these changes have come to Ireland, and his fear that we could go backwards. That was really a very eloquent letter as well.
So it was about 2 hours of performances with interludes of music by Damien Dempsey. Overall, what did you think of it?
Overall, I thought it was really well produced, and there was a sense of dignity. The tone was quite sombre. And I would have, the only thing I would say is with the music, I think it would have, it needed a little bit more light and shade rather than having Damien Dempsey four times, you know. So it made it quite heavy. And even though, yeah, of course, the topic is really serious, but it needed a little bit more variety. But it was beautifully done, I thought. Very, you know, inclusive and empathetic.
Elimini, thank you so much. Dear Ireland Continues is available to view at the Abbey Theatre website, which is simply abbeytheatre.ie. That's it for tonight's Arena. Research was by Paula Shields and Liam Murphy. Kieran Cullen was on sound. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator, and the programme was produced by Sinead Egan.